Welcome to the Hockey Writers Podcast, where your favorite THW contributors discuss the hottest topics around the NHL and hockey world every weekday, Monday through Friday. Listen daily on iHeartRadio and wherever you get your podcasts, and check out our other great content at thehockeywriters.com. I'm your host, Kyle Knopp, and today I'm joined by Peter Barachini and Colin Newby. Peter, Colin, how are you guys doing today?
Doing great. Glad to be back.
Well, glad to have you, Peter. And Colin, how are you today? Welcome on this Tuesday. We normally have you on Wednesdays.
Yeah, I'm doing real well. Had a coaching hire for the Flyers last week, so I feel like I haven't slept since the news.
Well, hopefully they'll take in consideration your sleeping schedule here soon and allow you to catch up on that. So we appreciate you being here with us today, and look forward to talking some hockey with you both. So let's get right into it. Game three was last night. Tampa Bay won 6-2, came out, won their first game of this final series at home. And so let's just kick things off. What were your thoughts in game three? What were the keys to the Tampa's win, and how can Colorado turn it back on? And Peter, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to say it's a do or die game, but it was a do or die game for Tampa Bay. I mean, you know, this is the second time they went down 2-0 in a series, and, you know, they came back with a vengeance. I mean, home ice advantage, they wanted to prove that last game was, you know, kind of a fluke, and, you know, losing 7-0, I think we were all kind of shocked at that kind of a loss, and they managed to come back and have the performance that they did. But, I thought that Tampa Bay did a better job of attacking the middle of the ice. I think that was key. You know, looking at the series numbers overall, the Lightning have, you know, found success when they attack the middle of the ice. I mean, in game one, they scored 3 goals, and I think 3 of the 4 goals came in that high danger area and made life difficult for Darcy Kemper. But overall, I think it was just a bad game on Kemper's part. 2 goals against in the first game from the high danger area. But I expected a little bit more from Darcy Kemper. He didn't make the saves that he normally would have in games 1 and 2 to try and keep his team in it. And, you know, you look at his goals or expected goals against for that game, it should have been 162, and he allowed in 5 with a save percentage at 615 at 5-on-5. So not really good. You know, I expected a little bit better from him. But you know what? The response from Tampa was great. They powered through, and despite not holding an advantage in, you know, shot attempts, they were, you know, they took advantage and capitalized on their opportunities. And I thought getting to the middle of the ice and attacking with force like they normally do was a big factor for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you brought up the biggest key to their win yesterday was that getting to the middle of the ice. And it you saw that in game two. They didn't get many shots at all. I think they only had 16 to end on, but they weren't getting anything from the middle of the ice. Everything was coming from the outside, and Kemper wasn't tested in game two. And then you saw that last night. So yeah, great points, Peter. Colin, I'd like to get your thoughts on that, on game three last night, and what the keys were to Tampa's turnaround and what the Avs need to do to turn it back on.
Well, I continue to be impressed by the top guys for Tampa. I think Andre Palat has really come into his own. He's played a lot with Stamkos and Kucherov in recent weeks. But the thing about Tampa that I always point to is that you think you have one thing down. Like I just mentioned that top line. Say the Avalanche try to focus in on that top line and shut them down. Well, what has been their recipe for success over the past couple of years? If you shut them down, some guy that you don't really know, like Ross Colton, might get the Stanley Cup winner. You might have Nick Paul score a crazy goal in game 7. That's what the Lightning do. They have the best goalie in the world. They have one of the best defensemen in the world in Victor Hedman. They're all over. So I think the depth of Tampa can still really show, even though the Avs took that commanding lead to start the series.
Yeah, I mean, you are absolutely correct when you talk about Tampa just being so deep. Like you said, they constantly have guys that can hurt you. And then, you know, down on the fourth line, they have Corey Perry, who won a league MVP years and years and years ago, but can still put goals home whenever he needs to. So, Kyle, you brought up a couple great points, but I think you're absolutely right. Having that depth that just comes at you in waves, and they're relentless, right? And that was something I didn't see out of the Tampa Bay Lightning in the first, well, in the second game, a little bit in the first game, but that relentlessness. And you saw it yesterday. Colorado jumped out to an early lead, and then Tampa struck back with two goals in the first and another goal in the third, or sorry, in the second to start that second out. And then Colorado got another goal back to kind of cut that lead in half. And then Tampa responded with three more goals in a row. So, you know, it's one of those things that when they are on, the Tampa Bay Lightning can hit you in waves. And they proved that last night.
Yep. And a quick nugget about Corey Perry that I found out last night on the ESPN broadcast in the U.S. They said he is the first NHL player ever to score four goals for four different teams in the Stanley Cup.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a pretty interesting nugget as well. And I made sure to include that in the morning skate this morning. So if you got your morning skate, you probably saw that in the last night's news section, but yeah, that's four goals, four Stanley Cup goals, four different teams. That is quite impressive. And, you know, we'll see if he can get it done this year, because the last 2 years haven't been kind to him. So sticking to last night's game real quick, actually we got a couple more topics on that, but just want to get your thoughts. And Colin, I'll come right back to you. Who gets to start in game four? Is it Darcy Kemper or is it Pavel Francouz?
I think it's got to be Darcy Kemper. It seemed like little hesitation after the Avalanche got past Edmonton, that when they found out Kemper was good to go health-wise, they put him right back in there. And I think in yesterday's show, Matthew was talking about how pulling Andre Vasilevsky in game two probably would have been the right move, even though you could just stick him right back in. I don't think it's any more than that with game three and Jared Bednar's choice to yank Kemper. I expect him back in there for game four.
If Bednar were to go with Francouz, does that show that there's a little, maybe a little gap in the armor of Colorado that's showing, or is that something that they're just that deep at goaltender that they can really go with a 1A, 1B?
Maybe a little bit. I didn't think of it that way, but I guess you could interpret that as a little bit of a sign of panic if it does happen. But one thing about Colorado is that I've never at any point felt that they were based off goaltending. So if you look at like the Pittsburgh Penguins of say 5 years ago, I think they were excellent up front, had a strong defense, and then they could get by with average goaltending. You might say a similar thing about this group that Colorado has right now.
I think that's a really good comparison, Colin. I think that's a really good comparison. Peter, over to you. Same question. Who starts in game four for the Colorado Avalanche? Is it back to Darcy Kemper or do they bring in Pavel Francouz?
Yeah, you got to go with Kemper. And it's just like in that, you know, 7-0 blowout, you know, there were contemplations about whether or not they would pull Andre Vasilevsky in because, you know, he's been their guy. He's, you know, been through these, you know, bouts of like poor performances before in the playoffs, and he's the best goaltender in the league. They went with him in this game. You got to go with your starter. You got to go with the best player at the moment. I mean, Francouz played extremely well when Kemper was out, but in these moments, you got to go with your starter. And Kemper has proven to bounce back and provide stellar goaltending after, you know, a loss. And finding the stat, he allowed four goals against High Danger in that game last night. So, yeah, you just got to go with him. I don't think it's that much of a, you shouldn't galaxy brain this and overthink things. He's your starter. You go with the best player, and he's been their best player throughout the whole entire season. Rough start, but he picked it up and he showed why. So he got them to this point. You just got to go with him.
I mean, I think you're right in the sense, Peter, that you continuously go back to your guy, right? The guy that got you there, and you keep going to him. And, you know, that's how Vasilevskiy became Vasilevskiy. They didn't start pulling him and then not leaving him to come back in or not letting him have a chance to redeem himself. If that never happened, you know, we might never see that, you know, 17-0 run that he went on after a loss or whatever crazy stat he has right now after an eliminate or in an elimination game. I don't have that record up, but I know it's pretty crazy. But that's, those are good points. And I think, you know, should Kemper get shelled again in that game four, then maybe this is a legitimate question where we come back and say, you know, Pavel Francouz has proven that he can win in this playoff series. In these playoffs where he's proven that he can come in and calm hot teams, you know, the couple games he has come in late for relief. He's only given up a goal or zero goals in those appearances. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is something that to keep in your back pocket if you are Colorado, but I think you are both absolutely correct and you go back to Darcy Kemper. All right. I want to talk about that disallowed goal in the first period. And there's quite a bit of a delay between when the goal went in, the celebration happened, and right before the drop of the puck that allowed Tampa to really get a good look at that replay and see that that was offsides. Now, my question to you, and Colin, I'm going to start with you. Is that something that should be coming from the coaches, Tampa Bay or Colorado? Should it have been reversed? Or is this something that needs to be coming from Toronto in the war room, in that video review room, that they should be looking at that right away and alerting the on-ice officials? So want to get your thoughts. That disallowed goal, that offsides, there's a little bit of a delay that allowed the Lightning to get it right. But should that come from the coaches on the ice or should that come from the war room?
Well, I don't know how I got so lucky. I was on the day after the Cale Makar offside call in the Western Conference Final. and then I saw this one. And I'm a little fed up with the replay system. I think what you said about Toronto should come into play. I mean, you have people watching this game with every replay available. It should be very quick to go through these things. And I just think it took forever last night. I think it slowed the game down. And I'm going to go back to the big picture more so than focusing on this individual circumstance. I just quite simply don't like instant replay. It's supposed to eliminate controversy and it just causes controversy all the time.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a good point that could be brought up and discussed in a podcast on its own, probably about that, about the replay. But I just want to get your thoughts because this was something that if Colorado had gotten that puck dropped and, you know, and the play had gone on, it would have been a 1-0 game for them. It would have been a completely different start to that game. You know, Tampa down one within the first 5 minutes. And then to have that, to go back into the locker room in between periods and then see, no, that was really offsides. It should have been 0-0. Like, I think you're absolutely right. I think that needs to come from Toronto. But I want to get Peter's thoughts first. What do you think about that disallowed goal? Should that have come from Toronto or is that something that the coaches need to be responsible for?
I mean, I think it comes down to the video coaches as well, because they were relaying that information to the coaches to make that challenge. But at the same time, I believe it was during the I was watching the Canadian broadcast, and apparently they said that they got their own separate war room in the stadium where they don't go to Toronto for that. I could be wrong. I may have heard something else, but that is possibly what I heard. And if they had the information and all the cameras and all the clips right there, right then and there in the building, to try and like speed up the process instead of having to call Toronto in a game like the Stanley Cup Finals, I understand why they would have their own separate war room. But even so, like the clip that they showed of the puck coming out and then, you know, you see Bo and Byram quickly, you know, shoot the puck back in. I saw White. I thought it was offside. I thought it was clearly offside no matter what, but I think it was just the timing between the relaying of the information from the video coaches to the actual coach and to to try and get the ref's attention before they dropped the puck. To me, I thought that was way too much time because they initially said they didn't want to challenge it until they got an initial clip saying that, yeah, we do want to challenge it. I think that, not to say that there should be a time limit, but if you say, no, we don't want to challenge, it just means no. You don't get that second option to say, yeah, we want to challenge it now.
Yeah, I mean, so I could agree with that,
it's a difficult situation.
Yeah. And last night, you know, Cooper mentions it in his post game conference, but you know, they didn't have all the angles that, yeah, that Toronto normally does, or that, you know, maybe the video coaches eventually got. But it was right at that last second, mm-hmm, they got a different angle that really showed the white, or at least they thought maybe it did, and they took a gamble. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that last night was a good call. It was offsides. It absolutely, yeah, was space between the blue line and the puck. But I think unless the coaches can have every single feed available to them right away, I think that needs to come from Toronto, because those, yeah, are the people that are paid to review those goals, and they should be reviewing them as soon as that puck goes in, mm-hmm, while the handshake line's going on, while the coaches are first discussing it on the bench. And they should have an idea of whether that needs to be allowed or not, or at least looked at again by the on-ice officials. But yeah, I think when you involve the coaches challenge that the NHL has allowed, it adds that, you know, kind of putting the onus on the coach of having to come up with that, you know, that video evidence first before they can challenge it. But in a game that could decide whether the Stanley Cup final goes 3-0 or 2-1, mm-hmm, absolutely, that needs to come from the people that are paid to be in that position. So that's my two cents on that. I think that needs to come from Toronto, and that needs to be a automatic, you know, maybe that's like a VAR in soccer where there's an automatic call down, but you know, there needs to be something that we can make that so there isn't as much of a delay, because that was a long delay. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a big factor in slowing down the Colorado's momentum, because that's a 1-0 game. 5 minutes in, Colorado's coming out hard, coming out fast. And then it slows them down. Yeah, they ended up getting another goal a couple minutes later, but it wasn't quite the same, you know, burst of energy that they had after that initial, you know, quote unquote goal.
I know we don't like to play hypothetical, but let's say they do.
Oh, allow... we love to play hypothetical, Peter.
Let's say they do allow that goal, and if Colorado still played the same way in front of Kemper, and Kemper allows all those high danger goals in the slot, I mean, it really wouldn't matter. It would still probably be a 6-3 game if they, yeah, did allow it, no matter what. Very depending true. On how it played out as it should have accordingly. Yeah, it could have changed the tides. It could have been a whole different momentum change. But if Colorado played the way that they did in front of Kemper, then I guess that goal, or it would, that good goal would ultimately be meaningless, and it would still technically be 2-1.
Yeah. That's very true. But then, you know, it could have gone many different ways, right?
Yeah.
That goal 5 minutes in could have sparked something that, mm-hmm, you know, started off another 7-0 game. but that's the thing, is we'll never know for sure. But I think eventually, you know, essentially the refs got it right. That was not a goal. And here we are, a 2-1 series now, and things are going to get interesting. So
yeah, that's great coach speak too, Peter. You know, don't blame the refs. We gotta improve our defense.
I have experience behind the bench as a coach, so yeah, I sign me up for the NHL if anybody needs a coach.
I love it. All right. Moving on, the last thing I want to talk about, and we don't have to touch on it much, but I just wanted to bring it up because it was an interesting play to kind of close out the third period. But that Devon Toews cross check on Nikita Kucherov, you know, and Cooper said it after the game. He doesn't want to speculate. Everyone saw it. Players know what they're doing, but Kucherov has a history of lower body injuries. And to me, it looked like Toews just kind of came in and took quite a bit of liberties with that and tried to hurt Nikita, you know, or at least tried to drive him into the ground. So I want to get your thoughts. And Peter, I'll come to you first. What were your thoughts on that Taves cross-check on Kucherov? Was it dirty? Does it need to be looked at? Or was it just kind of a instance of playing in the moment?
Well, first off, I'm just going to say, whenever we think it's a suspension, it's not a suspension. And whenever we don't think it's a suspension, it is one. So who knows what's going to happen?
Very true.
But I think it was just a heat of a moment play and kind of a retaliatory play, because before that, there was a clip where Nikita Kucherov goes into the boards and he hits Manson from behind in the numbers. And that was a very dangerous hit. So I think maybe that was a message that maybe Taze was trying to send to Kucherov. Maybe didn't work out as he had hoped, because the stick did get him into the side. He did fall awkwardly. And I think more so the impact of Kucherov going to the boards is what did it more than the actual hit itself, because, you know, it was still a hit and he went in awkwardly. I think it was a heat of the moment thing. I think it was just trying to send a message because, hey, you almost knocked our guy out, hit from behind, very, very dangerous play. And that probably should have been a penalty from that angle that I saw. And I don't think Taze got anything for that one on Kucherov, but if that didn't happen, then maybe Taze didn't need to send a message, or maybe try and attack him and maybe didn't go as planned. Either way, you probably shouldn't have done that, considering that the game is still out of hand, or not out of hand, but, you know, out of reach with the score. But maybe just try and maybe take a step back, maybe send another message in another way, maybe just a little tap here and there. But yeah, heat of the moment thing. But I think it was more so in response to the Manson hit, which looked more dangerous than that one.
Okay. And in your thoughts, will there be any subsequent punishment to Taves, or did he serve his two and we're moving on?
Again, with the player safety, I have no idea. They're probably going to throw a dart at the board. So your guess is as good as mine at this point.
Well, that's why I wanted to get your guess. No, I would say no, though.
I wouldn't suspend it.
I feel bad for putting you on the spot, but not really. So, Colin, same question to you. I want to get your thoughts on that Taves cross check on Kucherov. Was it a dirty play in your mind, or was that just kind of a heat of the moment? We're in the Stanley Cup Finals. You got to take it.
Yeah, I would agree with Peter and say that it's a heat of the moment type of thing. It's just such a fast game. And even when you look at that slow motion replay, it looks like he kind of makes the hit before you see that awkward landing Kucherov had. He possibly went a little bit low, but I don't expect supplemental discipline. I expect Taze to be back in there, although that is a really good point. When you expect something to happen with player safety, sometimes you just don't know.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be any suspension for that. I mean, maybe it was Taves knew what he was doing and added a little extra oomph to his as he was taking him down, you know, to give him that little extra. But he got the 2 minutes, and, you know, maybe he'll get the maximum allowable fine, which is what, 2,500, 5,000? I don't know. Depends on the penalty, apparently. Yeah. but yeah, so maybe he'll get a fine, but I don't see it being much more than that. But like you said, Peter, if we guess nothing, that means he'll probably have to serve a 2-year suspension or something. So who knows?
Yeah. And I have the initial impression that Kucherov is not seriously injured. At least that was the word this morning, but I really hope he's okay too. Yeah. You already have Sammy Girard out. Nazem Kadri hasn't played. Burakovsky has been in and out. Yeah. Yep. Braden Point too.
Sat out game three.
Hopefully it blows over.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the best time of the year. You get the best team versus the best team, right? You want to see them with all their best players. But yeah, it's also the end of what are we at here? Almost 10 months of a season so far. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, these guys are not as healthy as they have been all year. So this is, yeah, it's one of those things like you're playing through injuries, and I know playing through an injury, if someone kind of, you know, tries to aggravate it or lands on it or gives it a little extra push, man, you're hurting, you're feeling it, you're in your own head. All you want to do is just go lay in a pack of ice. And he didn't come out for his player of the game award, Kucherov, after he didn't come back in the third period. So my guess is he'll probably be okay. Obviously he's been having lower body issues the last couple of years, so it'll be interesting to see, but I hope he's okay, because, you know, like I just said, I want this to be best on best hockey. And that's what makes it that much more fun to watch as a fan. All right. Any final thoughts on game three or the Stanley Cup final before we move on?
I'm good.
All right.
Just hoping for close games from here on out.
Yes. I would like a couple more overtime games. Those are more fun for me, but as my buddy in Tampa, one of my best friends in Tampa, has been texting me after games one and two, just absolutely like, I could feel how wound up he was in those texts. And then last night's texts were a lot more calm. So I'll take that in terms of being a friend, but I like these close games a lot better. All right. The NHL awards are this evening. So of course we're going to play our best awards predictor here, and I want to get your thoughts. So we can keep this as short as you want, but I want to get your thoughts on what you expect for the awards tonight. So let's start with the award for the Hart Trophy going to the most valuable player. This year's finalists are Austin Matthews from the Toronto Maple Leafs, Connor McDavid from the Edmonton Oilers, and Igor Shesterkin from the New York Rangers. And Colin, let's start with you. Who is your vote for the Hart Trophy?
Well, I think my answer is going to make Peter pretty happy.
It probably will.
Austin Matthews. I think we have to keep in mind that the timing of these awards changes the perception, but the playoffs have nothing to do with this.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I think Austin Matthews really carried the Leafs down the stretch, especially headed into the postseason. I think he's your choice here.
Great point. Peter, over to you. Hart Trophy.
Yeah, definitely Austin Matthews. I mean, the first 60 goal scorer since, I believe, it was Steven Stamkos to hit that mark. And, you say what you want about the playoffs, but this is all based on regular season, right? So you have to think that, the Maple Leafs wouldn't have the record-breaking season without the impact and the goal scoring that Austin Matthews brings every single night. So hard to not give him the award, because he made history. And that's just, that's just a fact. I'm not putting my Leaf bias into this. I would do this if Austin Matthews was a Ranger, a Bruin, a Habs, you name it. It's record-breaking. He deserves it.
Yeah, what McDavid did with 123 points this year was absolutely insane. He won it last year after going, 105 points in 52 games or something crazy like that. Absolutely, he should be considered for this award. He's been absolutely phenomenal and electric and exciting to watch. And then Shesterkin is very well deserving as well. And I remember, I want to say it was last year or the year before, when Vasilevskiy was in the Vezina talks, and a lot of people were trying to say that he should be in the Hart conversation as well, but he wasn't. And now all of a sudden Shesterkin is, and he put up pretty similar numbers to what Vasilevskiy did that season. But I think you're absolutely right. If the postseason were taken into consideration, this might be a Shesterkin versus McDavid battle. But this has to go to Matthews. First 60 goal scorer in 10 years. First American born player to do it. And like you said, he just continued to just pump him in at a pace that we haven't seen in quite a while. And he was very exciting up there in Toronto. So, I think I'm going to agree with both of you and give this slight edge to Austin Matthews this year. But man, what a fun year to be watching these three players play, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of best goaltender, Who do you have for the Vezina Trophy? The just talked about Shesterkin being the heart consideration, so it seems that it should go to him, but he has to compete with Jacob Markstrom of the Calgary Flames and UC Saros, who had a great first season as a primary starter with the Nashville Predators. So, Peter, who do you have?
Yeah, I feel bad for Shesterkin because he deserves a Hart Trophy as well, but I'm going to give him the Vezina. I mean, just the numbers that he put up this season was absolutely phenomenal. To come in, taking over like Henrik Lundqvist, who was the king of New York for the crease of the longest time, and he's already cemented himself as a starter going forward, and he was absolutely phenomenal in the regular season, even into the playoffs. He was giving the New York Rangers a fighting chance every single night. So I'm giving it to Shesterkin.
Yeah. Great point. Colin, who do you have for your Vezina?
Well, we'll agree on both of these so far. I think Shesterkin's the overwhelming favorite. The best year by a goalie was Shesterkin. That's what this award is about. I think Vasilevsky is probably the best goalie, but Shesterkin had a better year. And Nikita Kucherov reminded us of that after the cup last year when he had his shirt off and a beer next to him, that Vasilevsky's the best, even if he doesn't win the Vezina.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think, to have a conversation where you talk about one of the goalies being the best player, the NHL MVP, and then to say that he doesn't deserve to be the goaltending MVP is quite a slap in the face to not just Rangers fans, but I think, hockey fans everywhere. So absolutely, we are 2-for-2 in agreement right now. Mm-hmm. Igor Shesterkin with a 2.07 goals against average and .935 save percentage on the season wins our Vezina this year. All right, moving over to the Rookie of the Year, the Calder Trophy. Our three finalists this year are Toronto Maple Leafs rookie Michael Bunting, Anaheim Ducks forward Trevor Zegras, and Detroit Red Wings defenseman Moritz Seider. You know I had to. Come on. Yeah. So, Colin, who do you have between Bunting, Zegras, and Seider as your Calder Trophy Rookie of the Year?
So I impressed Peter on the first one with Austin Matthews. Now I'm going to impress Kyle with this one. I think it's Seider. He really impressed me in the game where the Red Wings visited Philadelphia, had the chance to watch him. That was the game where he just absolutely laid out Flyers winger Max Willman on a reverse hit. I think he's an excellent player, and I think Seider's the choice here.
Absolutely. Peter, over to you before I get my two cents, which I think everyone knows is coming.
Yeah. I mean, I joked about this with you on the grind line. I'm not going to joke about it now. It's got to be Moritz Seider. I mean, the amount of ice time that he had as a rookie, the points production that he did, and to be an all-around two-way threat for them, despite them still struggling, he was a bright spot for them. I mean, you could also throw in Lucas Raymond in there. I'm surprised he didn't get a vote as well. It's got to be Seider. I don't think there's any issue or there should be any second guessing about that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're gonna go 3-for-3 on agreement here. But I think you're absolutely right. I was a little surprised Raymond did not get a few more votes or consideration, but it kind of makes sense. Zegras, like we said, he had, if this were for the most creative rookie of the year, Zegras would win this hands down. The kid is absolutely insane what he can do with the puck and had a great season with 61 points. Nothing taking away from Bunting. He had a good season. He actually even started a little slow. He wasn't up there right from the get like Raymond was. And I think had Bunting not put up the numbers that he did, maybe Raymond gets in there instead of him. But I got to agree, this is more exciters. Trophy to lose, so to speak. I mean, he played a whole season with Danny DeKeyser and dragged poor Danny's corpse all over that ice and just had to play both the left and right position while he was out there. And so like Colin said, when I got to see Seider play in person, he is just an absolute force on that ice, and he commands respect when he's out there. And as a 21-year-old first year in the league, that's quite impressive, especially on defense and playing first line minutes the whole season. So I think we all know that I could talk about Cider for hours and hours, so I won't. But yeah, that's again, 3 for 3 on this. Moving over to the Norris Trophy best defenseman. And we will go with our three candidates here. We have Roman Josi, who put up about 92 points, I believe. 96 points. Thank you. Sorry, I had to scroll down because my my morning skate didn't load, and that's what I was using for my notes here. So Roman Josi and Kale McCarr and Victor Hedman, who are both going against each other head to head in the Stanley Cup final. You know, this is kind of a two man race right now. No disrespect to Victor Hedman, but this has got to be between McCarr, who had 86 points, and Josi, who had 96 points. So Peter, who do you have for your Norris Trophy winner?
It's Roman Josi. I mean, looking at, according to NHL, since 1990-91, only four or five or seven players have hit the 90-point mark, and that was Ray Bourque twice, Paul Coffey, Phil Housley, Brian Leetch, and McInnes had 100 points in their seasons. McInnes 90-91, Brian Leetch 91-92, but Roman Josi is the first. It looks like he is the first player to hit the 90-point mark by a defenseman, and joining those, you know, elite level Hall of Famer defensemen right there. And you know, to do that in 80 games, he only missed two. Putting up those numbers, being a factor at even strength and on the power play. Actually, his even strength point production outweighed his power plays, 59-37, and he still maintained a very steady two-way game. And I think that's where the award should come in. It shouldn't just be about offense. It should be about defense. He's very solid at his own end, getting to the lanes. And for him to still do that, miss two games with shot blocking and all that, and to put up the points that he did, I to me, it's going to be Josi.
Great. I mean, great points. This is the best defensive player all around at his position award. So you're absolutely right. You got to take into account both the offensive numbers, but the defensive stalwart that you need to be to play that, that position. So Colin, over to you. Who do you have for your Norris Trophy winner?
So a few minutes ago, I said the Vezina was the easiest one. I think Durkin is the landslide winner. This, I'd say, is the toughest one, actually. I've always loved Josi, and I actually think you could make a case for him as the Hart winner, because Nashville wouldn't have been in the playoffs without Josi. But I think the pick here is Cale Makar. I'm finally going to go contrary.
Like it,
but it's very hard not to pick him. Peter makes a great point about the all-around game, but I wanted to say about McCarr, at the beginning of the year, I guess I kind of had this impression that he was the offensive puck mover, not the biggest guy, but as I watched him a little bit more, I'm impressed with his defensive game. And again, I'm trying to remove playoff perception here, because obviously there's recency bias, but I think it's tough not to pick Cale Makar. And also, if you look at the voting trends, this award has gone to a lot of veterans in the past, but maybe that's changing because Adam Fox had the surprise Norris Trophy last year, and I think maybe that gives Makar a better chance.
And also McCarr played in fewer games less than Josi too. So I think if he would have didn't miss the games that he had, he probably would have been up in that 90 point range as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was extremely close. And as you could see from game two, all he needs is one period to rip off 3 points. So, I mean, he easily could have done that, but I think you're absolutely right. This is a very, very close race, I would say, but to me, this has to go to Roman Josi. And I think Peter and Colin, you make great points. And believe Colin, was it you that said he could have been the Hart Trophy consideration at least? Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I don't think Nashville gets even close to the playoffs without Yossi's production this year or Saros's production this year. You could put those two hand in hand. But yeah, I mean, to put up 96 points as the defenseman, 32-year-old defenseman at that, and still play top minutes against, you know, the other team's best players, game in and game out. You know, I believe Cale Makar is going to win plenty of Norris trophies. I don't think this is going to be the last we see of him in this conversation, but I think this year it goes to Roman Yossi. All right. Our final award that will be presented tonight is voted on by the NHL Players Association, and that is the Ted Lindsay Award for the most outstanding player. So this is the award given to the most outstanding player as voted on by all the other players. So it's who the players think is the hardest to play against or is the best player in the league. So I feel like this one is garners the most respect because it's your peers voting for you and not the media. So this year's nominees are Roman Yossi, Connor McDavid, and Austin Matthews. And this might be one of the hardest ones to decide. So, Colin, let's come over to you first. Who do you have winning your Ted Lindsay Award for most outstanding player as voted on by the NHLPA?
So I think this is the most prevalent case in that you have to look at the language of these awards and really define what they actually mean. So right after I say Austin Matthews is the most valuable player, I think Connor McDavid is the most outstanding. Again, it's a little bit of a gray area to define these things, but Connor McDavid, I think, is the best player in the game. Just so difficult to defend with that speed, especially.
Oh, yeah.
I was a little bit surprised that Cale Makar wasn't a finalist, at least. But I still think the pick is Connor McDavid here.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a couple guys that could have been on this list, but that just goes to show you how exciting and entertaining this NHL season was, that there are so many guys that are deserving of this award that, you know, we could talk about dark horses that aren't even on the ballot. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right in terms of McDavid being the best player in the NHL right now. Peter, you got the last word on these NHL awards. Who is your Ted Lindsay Award winner for most outstanding player as voted on by the NHL Players Association?
For me, if this was a test, I would hope there would be a D option for all the above, and I would go all the above. But, you know, you just said it, voted by the peers. And I think, you know, Connor McDavid continues to do outstanding things, and he just absolutely amazes us. Even when we think he's reached his ceiling, he's going above and beyond. And yeah, the points, again, the production that he had this season, again, kind of like Colin, I don't think he was most valuable, but he is, in the eyes of his peers, the most outstanding player in the league. And the way that he's been playing recently, it's just, you know, It's hard to say that he isn't. And again, you can still make the case for Austin Matthews. You can still make the case for Roman Yossi. But I think with the way that McDavid finding another gear every single season, I think it's probably going to go to him. But don't count out Matthews or Yossi for this award.
Yeah, and you know, like I mentioned, setting this award up, you know, it's voted on by the peers. So it's voted on by guys that see these guys on the ice all the time that have to play against them. But you're absolutely right. It depends on how it's worded. You know, like you said, if it was the most valuable player, I would say probably Matthews, maybe even Yossi. He was probably the most valuable to his team. If it's one of the hardest players to play against, I might say Yossi this year and go off script just because of what he put up, 96 points and playing that top line defense and as a shutdown defenseman and really getting his team into the playoffs. But the award is for most outstanding player. And there's only one player that continues to deliver on being outstanding year in and year out. And that is Connor McDavid. So I was going to go off script and pick Yossi for this one is kind of a dark horse, but I think you're both absolutely right. And it's worded as the most outstanding player. And if Connor McDavid is on the ballot, I don't think you can pick anyone else to be more outstanding than him. All right. Any other final thoughts on the awards before we move on? What are your thoughts on Keenan Thompson hosting it? Good or bad for the league? Let me ask you that real quick, Peter.
I mean, it's always good when you get a former Mighty Duck in. No, I mean, plain and simple,
knuckle puck, baby,
knuckle puck. Exactly. Like, it's always a good thing.
Absolutely. Colin, agree, I am assuming.
Yeah, I agree. Got to get Russ Tyler in there.
Sorry for throwing that curveball at you, but I came to my mind. I was like, I gotta try it. Gotta see what they say.
Well,
so
I'm happy you did.
Oh yeah.
All right. Now moving on to our articles of the day, and I will begin. My article today is 3 Bruins defensemen who could be on the move this offseason, and that is by Vince Riley. And Vince lays out 3 Bruins defensemen who will likely be on the move, and one of them is not who you think it might be. I mean, obviously, we heard Charlie McAvoy last season and Jake DeBrus rumors of them wanting to be gone. So we'll see what kind of happens this offseason if that goes. But the 3 that Vince bring up in his article are Matt Grzelcyk, Mike Riley, and Jack Achan, right? Achan. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but so the 3 that Vince talks about are Grzelcyk, Riley, and Achan, and he talks about what they could bring in terms of either trade, trade bait for teams this season, or if they decide not to bring them back in terms of re-signing. So 3 Bruins defensemen who could be on the move this offseason by Vince Riley. A great little read about what is going on in Boston. And Peter, you and I kind of joked about before we got on the air about doing a complete rebuild in Boston. I don't think that's going to happen, but Vince Riley kind of sets the stage for a potential rebuild in Beantown. So that again, 3 Boston Bruins defensemen that could be on the move this offseason by Vince Riley. And Colin, I see your name up first, so I'll come over to you for your article of the day.
So I have notable NHL captains who got traded. This is by Ryan Gagne, and I'm digging up the archives a little bit. This was published last year, but republished the other day. And I'm a sucker for trivia bits. And this article has a great one, but it was the light of the Jack Eichel saga last year. So Eichel did not make the list, but it's certainly relevant to the conversation. But first, I wanted to get out that trivia. When was the last time 2 captains were traded for each other straight up? And that was Ryan Callahan and Marty St. Louis in 2014. If you remember the relationship between Marty St. Louis and Steve Yzerman kind of soured. Yep. But I'm going to run through this list pretty quickly because there's 10. They have Erik Karlsson, Mike Richards, Ron Francis, Jerome Iginla, Mark Messier. And then just a quick word on Jaromir Jagr, traded from the Penguins to the Caps back in 2001. If you take a look at the package that the Penguins got back for Jagr, pretty underwhelming for the second leading scorer in the game's history. Another one I wanted to focus on was Joe Thornton. With the benefit of hindsight, this is probably the most interesting one. I was a young kid when Thornton got traded, but it really blows my mind now when thinking about it. And another great piece of trivia, he is the only player in the 4 North American pro sports leagues, the major pro sports leagues, to be traded and win the MVP the next season. He won it in San Jose in his first year. And then the last 2, Raymond Bork, when he left Boston, he ended up winning the cup with Colorado in his last game ever. That was an excellent storyline that all NHL fans enjoyed. And of course, the number 1 trade was pretty obvious. It was Wayne Gretzky from the Oilers to the Kings in 1988.
Yeah, this is a fun article to go back through. And I love these types of historical articles as well. And the trivia late in ones. But yeah, I remember the Callahan St. Louis trade as someone that covers the Red Wings and is on the Red Wings Grindline podcast quite a bit. You know, we talk Steve Yzerman all the time. And so when I first started with the Hockey Writers, I was covering the Tampa Bay Lightning and then moved over to the Red Wings. So I was talking Steve Yzerman quite a bit ever since I joined the Hockey Writers. And so that was one that came to mind for me. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Some good trivia in this. And I love the Joe Thornton call out because I remember that trade. I remember when he was sent to San Jose and thinking, what are the Bruins doing? Because I'm pretty sure he was leading the league in scoring at that time, or he was at least very close to it, and then ended up getting traded and then finishing the season in San Jose and won the Art Ross and Hart trophies, you know, which is pretty crazy to think that a team's going to trade an Art Ross or Hart Trophy winner in that season. So, you know, you don't see Edmonton looking to deal Connor McDavid right now, which is basically what that trade ended up being. So great article, Colin. Fantastic read, a lot of fun. Peter, over to you. What is your article of the day?
Yeah, my article of the day is Maple Leafs commentary. Would Josh Anderson be a good addition? And it's an interesting question because the Maple Leafs are looking for help on the left side. Even though Josh Anderson is a right winger, he does fit the bill of what they're looking for in terms of, you know, more physicality, more strength, and even more speed because he is a fantastic skater. The only downside is, you know, his contract still isn't very appealing. I think his contract is at 5.5 for another few seasons, or five seasons remaining at 5.5, which, if you're the Maple Leafs, you're cash strapped. You need to find value elsewhere in terms of that cap space. But if he were to come in, the old prof mentions that he could be the Maple Leafs version of Tom Wilson, how he's big, he's tenacious, he's in your face, he can score, and he can skate. And that's the most important thing. He fits the Maple Leafs style of that puck possession, quick transitional game. And Josh Anderson has speed to boot. His season wasn't great, 32 points in 69 games, but if he was healthy and played, you know, a few more games, hopefully he could have hit that 45-50 point mark and he could be an Alex Killorn type of player. Maybe not as much offensive output, but that same style in terms of a rugged winger. So that was my main takeaway from that. It was a great read from the prof and how his fit in the roster might work out. And that's Maple Leafs commentary. Would Josh Anderson be a good addition?
Yeah, I like this article for a lot of those reasons you mentioned, but also because the Maple Leafs, all I've been hearing over the last, you know, 3-4 weeks since they've been eliminated is they need grit. They need grit. Mm-hmm. They need grit. They need grit. They need grit. And, you know, they were talking about maybe going after a Tyler Bertuzzi type player for a while. They're talking about going after a couple other guys, but Josh Anderson, 6'4", 225 pounds. I always forget how big he is.
Yeah.
You know, he plays physical and he plays big, but he doesn't appear big. And by that, I mean, when you look at like a Tom Wilson or a Ryan Reeves, you're like, damn, those guys are big. But when you look at Josh Anderson, until he's getting mixing it up, he doesn't really play as big, but he can. And that's the thing, is he can play big. And that's something that Toronto desperately needs, especially if they're finally going to get out of that first round.
Yeah.
So I think that's a great call out, a great choice to your article. I mean, I think Anderson would be a great fit in Toronto, actually. And like you said, I think he could play that left side, even though he's a right wing, and then he would have on his offside, which would allow him to probably create some more offense as well. And like you said, be a Tom Wilson, which, as we saw for the Washington Capitals last couple of years, Wilson's been producing as well as being that grit that the Capitals have needed as well.
Still present in the game, no matter what some people like to think.
Yeah, absolutely. You need it. You need it. And now enforcers are going, you know, the way, you know, of the dinosaurs almost, but you still need them out there and you still need those guys that can patrol the ice when you need to, but also
are able to score when called upon. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the Hockey Writers Podcast. Thank you for listening, and make sure to listen to new episodes Monday through Friday on iHeartRadio and wherever you get your podcasts. And also make sure to check out our other great content at thehockeywriters.com. From Kyle Knopp, Peter Barrichini, and Colin Newby, this has been the Hockey Writers Podcast.